Hip is my guest. And I have a great guest today. But I got to tell you, people, you know, you've listened to, you know, I had the heart problem, so I had to give up, you know, I gave up pretty much alcohol, junk food, caffeine, all my addictions. And I have a new addiction, and it's called Viggle. Now, I don't know if you know what Viggle is, but it's an app. It's an app where, my girlfriend told me about it, it's an app where you listen to TV shows and you get points. And so I'm learning that you, and they say special, you know, you get a point a minute of a TV show. But if you check in, there's some shows like it's 100 for checking or 150 for checking. And I've learned that if you check into a show but don't check out of it, I thought it listened to your TV. It doesn't. So you will be checked in the show. Like right now, I'm in the studio. I'm checked into the U.S. Open. So I'm getting all those points. So it's just, you got to do it. My points are accumulating. But they have iTunes cards. They have stuff. So go to Viggle. It's an app. I'm not sponsored by them. It was just, I was like, what the hell? But then I'm like addicted to it. It's like my addiction. Like if I can't sleep at night, I woke up at 3 a.m, I put Mike and Mike on. And because I have the East and West Coast, the difference, I can sit there and go, okay, I can watch this show at 6 o'clock and do it, but when everyone else can just watch at night. So that's all I wanted to say. Just go to Viggle. It's fun, and I'm addicted to it. But anyway, we have a great show. This gentleman, we're going to talk about a lot of his performing. His name's Graham. How are you doing, Graham?
I'm good, my friend. Thanks for having me on the show, man. I have not heard of Viggle. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, someone just told me about it. And it's like, and I went to their website. It's basic, but it's like, if you watch TV, or even if you, even like right now, I'm getting points. Now they'll hear this and they'll go, we better change the system. And you get bonus points, like, for watching like $150 for Push Girls. Well, I'm not really going to watch Push Girls, but you change. I guess it's like the way Shazam used to work.
Uh-huh.
Like, I guess, do you have an iPhone?
Yeah.
See, I have a Galaxy, Samsung Galaxy, and it was, I guess Shazam came on iTunes where you could play and you know the song.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this just picks up the TV and then like I'll look on the guide to see like the longest show. Like this morning, the other night, I was going to sleep. So I touched in the Sabado Gigante, and I get these points. But, you know, we've never worked together, but I met you a while ago. We were supposed to do a show at the Ice House in the Annex for a guy named Justin Daniel. No.
No
one showed up.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, I felt so bad.
The thing is, I guess you were like his favorite act.
Yeah, he's a real nice guy. And he was trying so hard to make this thing, and I felt so bad.
And you feel, and he apologizes to you, and it's like, you know, we've been there. It's not your fault.
I know. It's trying to get an audience at shows in Los Angeles is a raving pain in the ass.
Yeah,
it always is.
Me and Jen were just talking about that, the bringer stuff and all. It's crazy. Most of your friends are probably comics or people in the real world.
Right. So to attract regular people, you have to have these giant names on the show. And, the internet and podcasting is changing some of that because you're developing these comedy fans now,
right,
who are a little more knowledgeable and they know comics that aren't as well known and stuff like that. So that helps. But, man, I know he was so apologetic. I go, dude. You know, trust me, this isn't the first time this has happened to me. It won't be the last. And
right.
It won't be the last to you either.
Yeah,
you
know? It's just sucks. I used to host the show at Flappers, and it was Cooper's Angels, and it was, you know, they're really good female comics, and they're not going to bring people. And it was such a good show. Like, people who went, because it was solid acts, you know, it was like, I mean, from head to toe,
uh-huh.
I was like, because my name was attached to it. But, yeah, it's weird. So, now, where are you from originally?
I'm originally from Chicago.
Okay, now...
So I started doing stand-up there. Actually, I started when I was in college at the University of Arizona.
Okay.
And then I graduated. I went back to Chicago where I was from. And then I started doing stand-up, and I met, you know, like Jimmy Pardo and Mike Schmidt and Paul Gilmartin and Mike Siegel and guys like that.
Okay. Now, when you were a kid, well, I know, because we'll later talk about how you met Chris, because both of you guys are filmmakers.
Uh-huh.
But it's like, when you were a kid, were you... into comedy or into movies, or did something just catch you at a young age, or what was your influence?
I was into both, you know what I mean? I remember as a kid, my whole family gathering around to listen to Steve Martin's album.
Okay, yeah, okay.
And that was like, I thought he was amazing. I remember staying up late to watch Saturday Night Live.
All right.
And I also loved films. My parents would take me to like R-rated movies and stuff when I was a kid, and so
okay.
I got to see these really amazing films on the big screen. And I just sort of fell in love with the whole thing. My parents were like theater people, so it was like we did plays and stuff
right.
at Christmas and all that. So I really was sort of exposed to performing and to film and just being on any sort of creative endeavor at an early age.
Now, is there a certain movie that sticks out when you were younger that you went, wow, just blew you away? Because, like, I remember for me, I remember, and I still, we used to go camping, and we like the camping mm-hmm. weekend trailer. And I remember seeing, I believe it was The Bridge Over River.
Oh, right? I saw that as a kid.
I saw that, and when he drops on and the bridge blows up. And as a kid, I really didn't understand it because it seemed so long, but I still vividly, in my mind, every time I flip around, if I see it, I go, I got to put on the ending, because I didn't understand the movie, but I just remembered it.
I remember seeing that movie as a kid. We were living, my dad was a professor, and he had a Fulbright, he had a research scholarship, and we were in Germany.
Okay.
And there was this movie theater called The American House, and it would play American movies.
All right.
And we went to go see that there, and obviously, it was, you know, it had come out, whatever, 10, 15 years prior. But I saw that on the big screen and was like, that you would think, and I was 5 or 6.
Right.
You would think a 5-year-old would be like, boring. I was so engrossed in that movie and was just like the heat, the tension of it, Alec Guinness. I was like, this movie is spectacular.
Right.
It's one of the first moments or memories I have of watching a movie in the theater as a kid.
Okay.
And it was...
It's amazing, though, because I remember seeing it on TV, and I can imagine a theater, because at that age, you're so young,
sure,
and you watch it, and it's like, you don't know what's... I mean, you're used to watching cartoons.
Yeah.
You see something that's just
Sesame
like,
Street and I mean, all that business.
I mean, when I was a kid, I used to always get... It would always almost make me cry. There was... Back when there was movies that... Open for movies, like they had a shorter movie. There was one about this American Indian kid who always wanted to be a bird, and at the end he turned into the bird. And for some reason, like, touched my heart. And I'm like, I'm like almost, but it was like a happy cry. You know, it's like, right. It's like when Rocky yells Adrian and she gets to the ring. You tear up a little bit because it sets that happiness. So you're sitting there now, as you're going through, were you performing in high school or were you doing anything like
you
that?
You know, it was funny. Because it was so weird, this is so ridiculous. Because my parents were like theater people, my dad was a college theater professor, and I sort of rejected it a little bit and was really into sports when I was in high school. I played football throughout high school, and I played lacrosse my senior year, and was so into sports, and I didn't want to be in the drama club. Like, none of that really appealed to me, but my high school is a big high school. Evanston Township High School is a suburb of Chicago, and it had a cable TV channel, and I was a sportscaster for a couple of the basketball games. And oh my God, was that fun. I did it with two guys that were buddies of mine. Kevin Wilf was one guy, and now I'm blanking on the name of the other guy. Ted O'Connell. And I had I had so much fun doing that. I was like, this is kind of like performing.
Right.
And I really was like, And because I'd been around so much performing and, like, gone to plays that my dad had directed and stuff, it wasn't, like, a big jump for me.
Okay.
Nor were my parents like, you gotta get a real job.
Right, okay.
So I went to college and was a film major.
Now, how did you pick University of Arizona? You're coming from Chicago, which I've never been to Chicago, which is, I'm awful to say. Everyone gets mad at me. They go, what is wrong with you, Cooper? And I would love to go. And I had a friend, she lived in Chicago, and I was going to go out there. She lived there forever, and I never got out there. And then she broke up with her boyfriend. They used to live right in the loop or whatever.
So
I couldn't go. But, I mean, how did you pick Arizona? I mean,
Well, I'll tell you why. It was several things. I'd lived my whole life in the Midwest. I wanted to go to a part of the country I'd never been to before. And I wanted to go where it was warm, because the winters of Chicago. I just kind of picked that. You know, I thought about, you know, my grades were okay. I was like a B-C+ student in high school, much to the chagrin of my parents, because it was always like, if he only applied himself, he'd get straight A's, which was like the story of my life. But I went there, and I picked that school, and I was like, I've never been to Arizona. It was I just wanted to go somewhere completely different.
Okay.
And I went there, and I didn't even know what I wanted to major in, so I was like, I'll just go to a big state school because they, you know, if I switch majors.
Is that in Tempe?
No, that's Arizona State is in Tempe. University of Arizona is in Tucson.
Okay, how far is that from Tempe?
Hour and a half, maybe.
When I was in business, I went to a Tempe, and it's everywhere. There's just beautiful women.
Oh yeah. I'll never forget getting to that school as a freshman.
Okay.
And I was just like, this is what everyone's talking about.
No, because I mean, people don't understand that. It's like back east, and it's like, if you're not familiar with it, you know, like, Chicago is like Philadelphia, and you know, a woman can be beautiful in the summer, and then you see her in the winter, and she, and like especially when I was in college, yeah. they put on like 10 yeah. pounds because they can cover up. But yeah. out in Arizona, like everyone was like blonde and beautiful. I mean, I was like, man. Oh my God, how do people? I mean, it's crazy.
I had a lot of fun in school.
I had fun, and they weren't looking like you. They weren't looking like the girls you met.
It was great.
So you went as a film major.
Yeah, I went in there first. This is a great story. This will tell you why I got into show business unknowingly. I had to choose a major when I, you know, filled out my application for University of Arizona.
Okay.
And I was like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I was like, I don't know, maybe business or something. And so I picked economics because that was the major that Michael J. Fox's character on Family Ties had, Alex P. Keaton. So you would think that I was picking the major off of a fictional TV character that would have given me some insight into yeah. where I might be headed with my life.
And you pick like the most boring subject.
Economics!
Ever. I remember I fell asleep during economics one and two in college. I was sitting there, I remember it was like a 6 o'clock class on a Thursday, and all we could think about was where the party was.
Of course, where's so Nickel Beer Night start?
They're talking widgets and you're like, really? And you're looking at your watch, and we had 2 hour classes because my school is very weird. We only have 4 classes of 4 hours each and uh-huh. 4 credits. So it was, by the time after your freshman year, there's few ones that were like 3 hour and 30 minute classes. But by the time you were a junior, you knew you could pick a Tuesday, Thursday class and a Wednesday, Monday class, one at like 12 o'clock, so you have to get up, and one at 6 at night. But so that Thursday class, you'd be like, okay, I'm off for 3 days. It's time to party. And you just, and economics was just so boring.
Yeah, it was. And I took some of these classes, some of these like computer science classes, right. and I was just like, oh my God. And then I watched Ferris Bueller's Day Off again, and I went, I want to make that. I want to make movies. And I came home that day, and I switched my major to film. So okay. I was an econ major for a semester.
That's funny. That's like, you can tell people I minored in economics. Really?
It's like, I barely got 4 months out
but
of
it. But it must have been good because, I mean, you learned a little bit. So when you're making films, you have a little bit of a budgetary process.
Sure. Yeah, of course. So, four months of freshman economics made me...
A mogul.
Yeah.
You're running Fox Studio. So, okay, so you want to you become a film major. Now you had to make a film, right? I mean, what do they teach you as being a film major? I mean, it's like, did they teach you screenplay? Did they teach everything like screenplay, production,
directing? Well, they did a little bit of everything at University of Arizona. It was kind of a fledgling program at the time. I don't know what it's like now. I'd love to go back and see. And so you back then, of course, you were shooting everything on like 8mm and 16mm right. film. So you were learning basic stuff like shot composition and then the physical process of editing. Like you were physically cutting film.
Right, Chris has said that because it's the Comedy Film Nerds podcast. Mm-hmm. And Chris Mancini is his co-host, and Chris has been on. And I remember Chris used to always come into the comedy clubs and be like bummed because I mean he had to raise money for this, and it was so expensive you look at it now, it's like I'm looking back, it's like $10,000 or $15,000 for like a 10-minute film or something crazy.
I could fund. I did a short film 10 years ago called Hello Junkie, which is a parody of 70s cop shows. And so we shot it on 35mm as this character. I'd been this like tough-as-nails street cop who did beat poetry, and so it was this joke character I'd been doing forever. And we shot on 35mm. It cost me about $30,000.
Right.
I could shoot a feature film now. That money.
It's amazing.
For the digital tech. And it would look beautiful, like beautiful cameras. I could shoot the whole thing for $30,000 in a month.
Oh, yeah. And the funny thing is, it's like when you say it in film school, Chris said the same thing. You actually had to splice film.
Yep.
Like
uh-huh.
Not like, oh, let me get Movie Master on the thing.
No.
You actually had to
physically cut it and pick the frame you had to cut. And you had to save your frames because what if I need that? That's where the expression cutting room floor comes from. Because you physically, I mean, literally, an actor could be physically lying on the floor after their scene got cut out. That's how it was in the old days. So it was like, that's what I was learning. And the transition into digital was talked about, but it was this sort of fantasy faraway concept that some people might venture into at the time. And so, but it was cool. But then I also had a lot of film theory classes. Like we studied, you know, Hitchcock extensively and, you know, a lot of classic filmmakers. And that was really eye opening for me.
Now, were you also learning to write screenplays or were you?
Yeah, there was some screenwriting classes, but it was sort of, if I remember correctly, you could pick film and then a, and then you picked like almost like a, they called it like a focus, like almost like a minor, like I'm a film major with a writing minor.
Okay.
Or, so
right.
My focus was production. So I really didn't get into that much screenwriting. And that, it was really interesting. And by my senior year, I rarely was in class because the production classes were like, okay, this is the kind of movie you have to make. These are the editing hours. These are the office hours. Good luck. It's due the end of the semester.
Okay.
Now, and I loved that.
Now, what was, did you, the, what movie did you make? Did you write it or did someone else write it for you? Or did you...
I wrote it and it was just real, real, you know, they wanted you to hit certain thematic things. Like you had to tell this type of a story. And it was really teaching you how to scrape together a film.
All right.
And like, you know, I'll help you on your film, you help me on mine, and how to deal with the logistics of making a film. And I kind of liked that sort of sink or swim freedom that they gave you, because you just had to, like, your film is due the end of the semester.
Right.
Figure it out.
Yeah, it's like I said before, like when I first, before, you know, all the map quests and stuff, like when I would book a gig in like Ohio.
Yeah, remember that?
You'd call for the directions and they'd be like, okay, it's off the whatever. And you're like, how do I, and then you go, oh my God, I have to get there. I have to go get a map.
Yeah.
That's why I think a lot of comics join AAA.
They
would plot your ride.
Yeah, you plot and your ride, you have AAA. Or you do, I remember the back of the Atlas, they would have that, it's this many miles from this city to this city. And so you'd kind of go, well, this gig is between Chicago and Minneapolis, so it's probably about...
It's true.
You know?
you would piece it together.
Yeah.
So, okay, so you get your film done, okay, and you graduate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, had you planned the whole time when you graduated to move back to Chicago?
I was debating between like New York, Chicago, or L.A.
Okay, no.
And I knew, I was like, New York, I'm not the East Coast is not for me. And I said, L.A. And I was like, Jay, I don't know if I'm ready to go to L.A. And I had started my freshman year is when I did my first ever stand up. I was in a stand up comedy competition my freshman year.
What made you decide to do it? Did you? Was it you went? Did people say, oh, you're funny? You're doing
this? I was, you know, I was the classic, you know, I was always the class clown and was into trouble and detention and stuff like that. So I was like, I'm going to get into stand-up. And I got into it and just sort of dove into it and said, I'm going to do this. And, you know, like a lot of us, you know, going to these open mics in Tucson at 11 o'clock on a Tuesday and I'm eating it every week. And I just was like, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to keep doing this. I'm going to keep doing this.
So you kept doing it through your school year?
Through my school, yeah.
Okay. Now were you... Did you feel your act, you were getting better, or did you stay stagnant? Because, I mean, it must be hard being in college, especially with, because you have crap to do. It's not like you have a regular job. I mean, and when you have a regular job, you could go do an open mic because it's nighttime. You work from time. But there, it's like college, you want to party, you want to do this.
Well, it was, you know, and it's Tucson, so there wasn't like a bunch of places to perform. There was Laughs Comedy Club had an open mic, and then maybe you'd get a gig here or there. But by the end of my last year at Arizona, I was doing it enough that I was kind of, I remember getting a couple of little one-nighters and stuff like that. And I realized, like, I'm going to go to Chicago because there was a lot of stand-up clubs there at the time. And I was like, there was Second City there. And I just thought, I think maybe that's kind of where I'm headed. Because I then joined a sketch comedy group when I was in college. And that was so much fun.
Right. I had done that when I got out of the business for a long time. I had one out here with some friends. And I just, that's the old thing, especially out here. It's like, let's get a sketch group. And everyone's like, all right. And everyone's full of crap usually. Yeah. But this, my friend owned a theater. And I said, how much would it cost? And I said, all right, guys, here's the deal. If you want to do it, we're getting the theater in 2 months. I will write the show. And it made it happen. And it was, and as for me, it was for coming from a background of stand-up. But sketch was just fun.
It's a blast. It was so much fun. I mean, you're doing these little 3-minute plays.
And you're always a different character.
Yeah. And you got to, whatever little crazy idea you got to do, and it was fun. It was, so I did that in college. And that's when I was like, you know, comedy and like sketch comedy was kind of where I was leaning.
Okay.
And so I went to Chicago because I'm like, there's Second City and there's all these sketch groups there. And I'm like, I can do stand-up and sketch there.
Did you just leave after you graduated? It's like, I graduated, I'm out of here?
Yeah.
Okay. So you get to Chicago and now you're doing stand-up. Now, did you, I mean, because you grew up there, you probably had an idea where to start. But did you start hitting, like, what comedy clubs did you start hitting? Or
the first open mic I started going to was, well, actually when I was there in the early 90s, there was like 12 or 14 clubs in the Chicago area. It was it was crazy. So there was the Funny Firm, which was this like 400 seat room in downtown Chicago that had an open mic. and I would go to that every week. And then there was just little open mics, and I just was like, I'm going to plug myself into this scene, and I'm going to make this work.
Okay.
And just started doing as many shows as I could. I got a job waiting tables. And then, you know, there's just a million. The thing about Chicago, which I'm sure was kind of similar for you in Philly, because there's all these cities. Within a six-hour drive of Chicago, you could fill your calendar.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was saying. Me, there was, like, the comedy cabarets. But back then, he had, like, nine of them. And it's just that I was a new comic, and he liked me. So back then, you know, when you hosted, you did 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. You actually got money.
Yeah.
And he would sit there, and he liked me, and he said, okay, you know, I'm going to play, bring you to these clubs four times a year because you're host every 3 months. Right there is 36 weeks of work.
Boom.
And then Mitchell's four, and then Comedy Five. And then you're like, all of a sudden you're looking going, wow, I am booked every weekend. And then you would start picking up one-nighters, or you could do open mics. There was Comedy Works and Comedy Factory Outlet. And once you started getting work, the open mics were great because you'd have to go wait in line or anything. You got slotted, and you got 8 minutes instead of 5 minutes. So it was like, and even then you could go, for me, you could go to D.C. or Baltimore. Yeah. And then back then they would put features up when you jumped up. But it was different. It's like, did you start getting work quickly?
I started getting work quickly, and after a year of living in Chicago, I quit my job waiting tables because I was making enough money full time.
Were you featuring or?
Yeah, I was featuring. MCing? I was emceeing, featuring, and started to occasionally like headline some real small room or one nighter and stuff like that. And so then I was in Chicago for just like 4 years, and by the end of the 4 years, I was sort of, you know, on a short list of comics in that town that were decent, and I was working all the time. I was making my living.
Okay.
And it was really cool. And I was like, it's time to go to L.A. And I had some friends that already moved out here, and I was like, I want to pursue film and TV. I was like, I don't want to just be a road comic.
Right. Now, when you were coming out to L.A., I mean, you said you wanted film because you liked the acting, you liked the sketch comedy. Did you also want to, at any time during this, did you want to pursue the filmmaking?
You know, the filmmaking thing was always sort of there. It wasn't like in the forefront of my thinking what I was doing, but it was there. Like when a lot of guys from the University of Arizona, several of us moved to Chicago and we started a sketch group there.
Okay.
And we shot some videos. You know, we shot some of our sketches, and one of them we shot this like half hour sketch TV show that aired on PBS in Chicago.
Okay.
And so we were just sort of, I was like always in that performing and filming something.
And you had the knowledge to make it happen. Like a lot of times it's like, I mean, I bought one of those little, it was on sale, one of those little Viggle cameras. Not Viggle, Viggles.
Yeah.
The Bloggy, the Sony Bloggy. Uh-huh. And it was like, you know, it's regularly $160. They were clearing it out, and it was a floor model, so it was $80. And then I got whatever, 15% off, so it was nothing. And it's a great little camera. I can't. I sit there. I got the little tripod. I was like, I don't even know how to use it. Like, but like, that's the thing. A lot of us, you have ideas, you don't know how to produce something. But you actually had the, especially for the production background, you knew how to say, okay, if we're gonna do this TV or whatever this sketch thing is, we're gonna shoot this. We're gonna shoot it. We're gonna do that. So that must have been a big help.
It was really cool, and it was fun, and it was like, you know, we were running around Chicago. We were in our 20s. I was doing shows and shooting sketches and you know, got to be on some little local cable access shows and stuff like that, which was fun. And it was really a fun time to be in Chicago. Being in your early 20s in Chicago was a blast. You know, there's just all these bars and it was really cool. So then I decided I'm moving to LA because I really wanted to pursue film and TV.
Did you move by yourself or did you?
I moved, all the guys I was in the sketch comedy group, we all moved out here right around the same time.
Now, had you ever been to LA before?
Once. Okay. When I played lacrosse in college, we drove through LA or something on the way to, we played UC Santa Barbara, and on the way we stopped in LA or something.
So how did you figure out where you're going to move?
Well, again, it was like Paul Gilmartin and Jimmy Pardo had moved here ahead of me, and they lived in North Hollywood.
Okay.
And so I came out here like a month before we moved and just sort of sussed it out and went, okay, I guess I'll live here. It's the cheapest, you know, the valley's the cheapest, and you can live in a building with a pool. Wow.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
So that was just like kid from the Midwest. Hey. So that was pretty much it, you know, and I look back now and go, man, I should have moved by the beach. But which is where I live now.
Okay.
But anyway, it was a fun time. You know, it was a struggle, you know, you move out here, you're broke and all that other stuff. And
now, did you get a day job when you're out here, or did you wait tables?
It was such a difficult thing because I couldn't really go on. I didn't want to go on the road all the time because I wanted to, you know, get an agent and go on auditions and stuff like that. And I was taking acting classes at night, and it was hard to find a job waiting tables here because everyone's an actor.
Yeah, it's like this is the only place where like you bring like a headshot.
It's insane. In Chicago, you walk down the street, you can get a job waiting tables that afternoon.
I think what's funny is I noticed this, and it's so different that, you know, when I go back to see my girlfriend, like when we went out, you know, we go out to dinner, and the waitresses or waiter, some of them are people who that's their job. And some are people who are going to college.
Yeah.
But the service is always really good.
Yeah.
Out here, it's like people who think they're too good for this job. Yeah. So the service sucks a lot. And you're like, wait a second. It's like, it was such a breath. It was such a breath of fresh air. It's like, oh my God. I'm like sitting there going, this person's actually talking to us, but not saying, oh, so what are you, like not saying, right. You know.
Are you important?
Yeah. When I said, oh, I live in LA, and they're, oh, cool. That's a house. You know, here, if it's like, you know, yeah. So you couldn't get a waiting table?
Couldn't get a job waiting tables. Couldn't get a job bartending. So I would on the weekend, when I was, a buddy of mine who lived in Oceanside, his family lived in Oceanside, California, that I went to college with. And one summer in college, I moved furniture for their family. They had a family moving business. So when I came back here, my buddy was like, you know, my dad, you want to sling couches, man. And so I would be on the weekends. It was the only time I could really work and not, and I could still do shows around town. I could still audition. I could still do acting class. So I'd wait tables, man. And it was, you know, it was, or no, I mean, I'd move furniture. Okay. So I'd go down to Orange County, basically, is where they worked out of. And I'd, you know, I'd move boxes and move furniture on the weekends.
See that? So it's that was like, so you weren't going on the road at all then?
Not really, no. The first year or so. And then I like started to go, I was like, I got to make some.
Right.
So I'd go a little bit on the road here, a little bit there. And then I started to get like, I got a little writing gig. Doug Benson actually helped me get a writing gig on the MTV Sports and Music Festival.
Okay.
And so I got a little writing gig here. And then I got a job as an internet. It was this internet show that we wrote on. Me and the guys in that comedy group, Fancy Ketchup, we all wrote on this show. And that was kind of like sweet. That was my first like writing. That's actually where I met Chris.
Okay.
And we worked on that show together. And then, you know, so then he just sort of, then I started getting some show business odd jobs,
right?
Being a PA, you know, writing this or this little, you know, I in a pilot or a couple $100 to do this indie film, and
but so much better than the couches.
So much better than slinging couches. Like, oh my God!
I'd be like, and you think it's like it's the weekend, and it's like you can't even go enjoy the weekend night because you got to wake up the next morning. It's so physical labor.
Oh, and you just it would be so sore. I mean, I think my buddy's dad was really cool, and the guys I worked with are really cool. But man, it's like $10 an hour in the heat, and you're just like, boo.
We're gonna take a quick break. Plug your stuff. What's going on your website? Everything before we take the break.
Yeah, comedyfilmnerds.com. Chris Mancini and I have a podcast that we do every week. It's a movie review podcast. We have a new book that just came out, Comedy Film Nerds Guide to Movies. I'll be headlining in Philly at the Helium Comedy Club September 5th through the 8th. Chris will be the feature act. Thursday, September 6th at Helium in Philly, we'll be doing a live Comedy Film Nerds recording in Philly.
You can do it in front of the crowd.
In front of the crowd with Sam Levine from Freaks and Geeks is in town shooting a TV show.
Okay.
And also Nick McElwain, who's on one of the sidekicks on Preston and Steve, is going to be there. So that'll be a fun show. And then the LA Podcast Festival, October 12th through 14th. Doug Benson's going to be on it. Greg Fitzsimmons, Todd Glass, Aisha Tyler, Jackie Cation, and many more, the Sklar Brothers. If you go to lapodfest.com, get your tickets now. We have discounted hotel rooms, but those are going fast. So check that out, lapodfest.com and comedyfilmnerds.com.
Definitely check that stuff out. People, you can hit me up at Cooper Talk on Twitter, CooperIndie100, INDIE100.com. Check out my past episodes at www.coopertalk.net. Also, my new blog is cooperthoughts.podbean.com. And follow me on Twitter because every Thursday night, it varies on times, I call into the Big Daddy Graham Show on 94 WIP Philadelphia. So check that out, and we're going to be right back with Graham Elwood. We're going to talk more about can we talk about Afghanistan?
Yeah.
Okay, because Chris had talked about that. And
sure.
Now, you know, be very Chris. And actually, the book, we'll talk about his book because it's a good book. And there's some great people doing what are they called? Segments.
Yeah.
So be right back. Here's a commercial. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests.
It's like flying high-priced hookers to your hotel room from New York.
Taking it slowly into my hot, wet...
Okay, maybe not. But it is cheaper. Cooper Talk. Looking for great deals on apparel? Visit OnlineSalesMart.com. Currently, we have authentic Armani designer sunglasses at $100 or more off original price. Novelty neckties of all types for under $10. Necktie sets at discounted prices. And high-quality and genuine leather dress shoes, wallets, handbags, briefcases, and more for less. Visit www.OnlineSalesMart.com. All major credit cards are accepted and all orders are shipped on the double. Once again, that's OnlineSalesMart.com.
Remember abundance. At Shakey's Pizza, don't cut back.
Cut loose with our all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
Less belt tightening.
More belt loosening. Shakey's all-you-can-eat bunch of lunch. Now just $6.99.
With supershopper.org, you can post your ad online in just 60 seconds. That's fast. That means that old junk sitting in your garage can be online in less time than it takes for you to stub your toe while looking for the light switch. List your electronics, furniture, automotive, garage sales, and more. If you can legally buy it and sell it, it's on. Supershopper.org. Job postings just $25. Everything else, free. That means you can post your resume, get a job, find an apartment, furnish it, sell your car, buy an SUV, adopt a pet, find a house, get a mortgage, find a handyman, sell the house, buy a beach house, buy a surfboard. Supershopper.org. Now you get it.
Would you like to find out how you can easily own gold and silver bullion? With oil prices and food costs skyrocketing, there's one sure way to hedge against inflation: owning precious metals. And we can show you how. Operators are standing by with your investor's kit on buying precious metals. Call 1-877-722-7032 to learn the secrets of protecting your net worth. Call now to learn how to hedge yourself with precious metals. We'll show you how to finance and own large amounts of precious metals with small amounts of money. This is not options or futures. We'll show you how to collateralize hundreds of thousands of dollars in precious metals with as little as a 25% investment. For an investor's kit with charts and graphs on the latest precious metals trends and opportunities, call 877-722-7032. That's 877-722-7032. To find out how you can own gold and silver and profit from the wild swings in today's economy. As with all speculative investments, purchasing precious metals involves a risk of loss and should be carefully evaluated prior to investing.
Indy100.com.
I didn't put the air on, people. That's why I heard some dead air. I was like, welcome back to, and I was talking, I was engrossed in something. And welcome back to Cooper Talk. I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. And that shows why, because I'm like a nerd today. I forgot to put that on. And even like the comedy film nerds going, man, you're a nerd. And so now, as I said, people, go check out his site. And the book is on Amazon, right?
Book is available on Amazon, hard copies and digital for Kindle and Nook and all that
stuff.
Now
explain to people what the book encompasses.
The Comedy Film Nerd's Guide to Movies is about 26 chapters, and we cover all these different genres of films. There's a chapter on Western and sci-fi and documentary, and Chris and I wrote 8 of the chapters ourselves, and then we got 11 contributing writers who have been writing movie reviews for us on comedyfilmnerds.com. And so we just came up with this. It took us 2 years to put this book together. And so we got great writers. We got Greg Proops. We've got Dean Haglund from X-Men, Jackie Cation, Laura House, Susie Nakamura, who's on that new show with Matthew Perry, and Mike Schmidt. And
I always crack up when you say Mike Schmidt, so I always think of baseball.
I think
of
baseball player. Yeah.
But that's a stellar group of people.
And it's so amazing. It is what we've kind of built Comedy Film Nerds up to be, which is informative and funny. It's comedians talking seriously about movies. And there's plenty of jokes in there, but there's also, and at the end of every chapter is a 10 best and 10 worst of every genre. Which was a lot of fun to do.
Oh, yeah, because you sit there, I used to always hate when people would sit there and they go, like when Fargo came out, I like Fargo. It's brilliant. And I go, well, why is it brilliant? And they had never had an answer. Yeah. I'm like, I mean, there's got to be something like Woody Allen. Annie Hall's brilliant. Why? Because he breaks all the screens. He does them animated. But it's so funny because a lot of times these film people are so full of crap. Well, like, your book's honest.
Well, thank you. The thing we realized was sort of missing from film books was humor.
Right.
It's all a lot of very stuffy, pretentious, not all of them, and there's a lot of really good film books out there from like Leonard Maltin and Ebert and those guys. They're very smart guys that know a lot about movies. But we just wanted to like because that's what you do. First of all, Chris and I both went to film school, so we've watched a lot of movies. But I think it's kind of indicative of comics. You know, you go on the road. You don't have to work till 8 o'clock at night.
Right.
You go to a movie.
Yep, exactly.
And so most of us see a lot of movies, and we talk a lot. We're in the green room at a comedy club talking about movies. That's kind of how it all started. And so the book is just really a sort of slick extension of that. And it was so much fun to do. And it's the first time I've never been a published author. Chris has
had a book before. Pacify Me.
And so it's been really cool. And I've been going on the road, and people are like, oh, I bought your book, and the reviews have been great. And, you know, everyone's trying to get the book autographed by all 13 writers.
Oh, see, that's cool. I should have brought mine in today.
Yeah, dude, what are you doing?
I should know, because Chris had it, and I was thinking, I should bring it in, but I didn't. And it's so funny because I'm writing a cookbook.
Nice.
No, it's because I have congestive heart failure.
Oh,
so
wow.
I have to eat healthy. And I figured I eat very healthy. I have to watch my sodium. I cook at home. And everyone says it's very hard to cook. Mine's a humorous view to a cookbook where you cook for one and all you need is a microwave, a Foreman grill, a pot, and a pan. But I cook amazing things. Like, I mean, I cook like the other, like last night, I had breaded tilapia fish tacos with peppers, onions, hatch peppers, onions, and black beans. And it's not like I spend a lot of money for it. It's like you learn how to cook and you know how to shop. And it's just amazing. But it's a humorous view. No one does that. It's like the movies, as you said.
Yeah.
You don't want to get a book because you're going, oh, God. You know, it's like, what's this? It's like there used to be a reviewer named David Elliott in San Diego when I lived there. And I'd read it and I go, and it used to be like, oh, it'd be so pretentious.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's an Adam Sandler movie. Of course it's that.
Yeah.
You're not going to see, you know, Blue Velvet or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what we brought, you know, and we don't come to it from like a sort of academic standpoint.
Right.
We come to it as we're fans of films. We all love movies.
Now, what were some of your chapters?
My chapters, I did Westerns, which was a fun chapter.
Now, the best Western?
Oh, boy.
That you put, your top three.
I don't have the list right in front of me. You're killing me.
How about?
One of the ones I put Shane is on there. I'm a huge, like, Outlaw Josie Wales.
Okay.
Those movies are
spaghetti
great.
Spaghetti Westerns?
Yes, the spaghetti Westerns are great. And of course, Stagecoach.
Okay. What were some of the worst? Do you remember? Because
Wagons East with John Candy.
Is that the best? Because Matt Weinhold was on. He told me, and I have to rent it. He told me like because Matt did sci-fi, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He told me like the worst thing where like the guy does acid.
No, he did. Matt did horror. Matt just did horror and sci-fi.
Sci-fi, yeah. No, because he told me it's like this guy does acid, and then he wants to become like a governor. It's just really weird because everyone remembers the worst. So he did Westerns. What other category?
Did you I did documentaries because I made a documentary.
We're going to talk about what are some of your favorite? Because I'm like not addicted because I'm addicted to Viggle, but no, but I love Netflix because I sit down and I stream it onto my TV, and the documentaries are just, there's so many of them.
The technology has really opened up documentaries on two fronts. One, because it's so cheap to shoot with cameras, you know, before to shoot with film, you know, documentaries, you got to roll so much footage. So it was really the documentary filmmaker was very handcuffed financially because of that. Now they don't. And cameras are light and you can put cameras everywhere. And then also now because the distribution is opened up because of the internet, there's these wonderful documentaries out there that you would, unless they came to some art house in your city and they were there for a week at best, you would miss them.
Right.
And now you get to see them. And like
they're so interesting.
They're so interesting.
I saw one called Dive, and it's about these guys in LA who have jobs, but they dumpster dive like at Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, but they get like this great meat and they talk how you know how the waste of food.
Yeah.
And it's something that you would never think of. Then you sit there and you because with the instant cue I scroll the documentaries and I go, oh, I gotta watch that, you know, because it's just different. Or there's one about a guy who just juices for a while to lose his fat. Fat, almost dead, and going on with my health problems. I said, "Oh, because I have to check this out." And there's just really interesting stories.
Well, that's what a good documentary is for me is sort of opening the door to some subculture or some people or area or region that you never would have known about.
Now, so what did you list as some of your best?
Well, some of my best are
just your favorite. I mean,
my favorite was basketball. Diaries is a great one. Like that's an excellent one. And the other documentary, God, I should have looked at this book before.
That's all right. If you don't remember, it's fine.
Inside Job, I really like. And also, you know, some of these, this is just off the top of my head, but RV Man about that guy that...
You know what? That's on Epix right now. The other night I couldn't sleep, and I put it on demand, and I dozed off because it was late at night. I've been having insomnia, but it was just weird. I guess this guy. It would look cool.
It's a really fascinating story, and everything about it is, again, you get in the world of this guy, and they do it the right way. They don't make fun of him and make him look like a freak. They show him as a human being. He's a peculiar guy, but you kind of are sad and you're engaged by what he's had to go through, and it's really fascinating. So that was, and then I also did Kung Fu movies and I did Cops and Robbers movies.
Now, how was it right picking your worst documentaries?
I mean, that was the toughest one.
That's sort of tough because like for me, and that's what's weird. Like most people, if you watch a movie and it sucks, you can go, that movie sucks.
And you can make fun of it.
Yeah, but some people watch documentaries and some documentaries are propaganda. I mean, right. When you think about it, it's just their view. But people, oh, it's amazing. It's like, yeah, well, he made this guy look like an idiot. Well, yeah, but look who he talked to. Uh-huh. I mean, it must be hard to pick some worst ones.
Documentary was tough. What I went for to find documentaries were ones that, and I said this in the chapter, what a documentary truly is. Obviously, nothing is going to be 100% objective.
Right.
But the goal of a documentarian is to at least reach for that. And to try to just say, I'm going to roll camera and document this story. So ones I put in the worst were ones that were clearly propaganda.
Okay.
And I take some heat for this, but like Bill Maher's Religious.
You know, you're
it's
like
not
third,
a documentary.
You're the third person that has been a guest on the show that we talked about said it's not a documentary.
It's not. It's Bill Maher saying, and I agree with a lot of Bill. I'm not a big organized religion guy. I agree with a lot of Bill Maher's politics.
Okay, okay.
But as far as a documentary goes, he didn't go, I'm going to just document religion in America. He went out to say, if you like religion, you're a moron, and I'm going to show you why.
Okay,
and so it's just him jamming his agenda down. It's not a documentary.
Right.
It's, Michael Moore.
See, thank you.
Is a very good filmmaker.
Yes, but is
they're not documentaries.
That's what I was talking about when the whole thing about the guns, when he went to see Heston. Heston's 80 years
Heston
old.
Alone.
Yeah, it's like that's what I try to tell people. Like, oh, this is great. I go, and you're right. His old like his TV show where he would pick on like the Canada and that stuff was great, and he's a great filmmaker. But it's like it's not a documentary.
It's not a documentary. I mean, look.
It's his view.
He's done a lot for making. And I put documentary in quotes, but making the documentary mainstream,
making
it money, which is good. But again, like in Bowling for Columbine, since you referenced that, he does bring up some good points, but then it's so tainted by his clear-cut agenda that he's trying to jam down your throat. Like if you want, like he raises the point of like when he's walking through Canada and no one locks their doors. And these people are like, I don't like my doors. And he's like, you ever been broken into? Yeah, but so what? You know, and just showing you, wow, maybe it is a problem with the way the American culture is. That's fascinating. But then when he goes to Charlton. Why is he hassling Charlton Heston for?
Or when he's talking to the congressman's sons who aren't going to go join the army. Of course they're not going to join the army because, you know, they're going to do what? They're going to go to the law school.
Yeah.
It's not because they're Congress. It's because if you went to different places, if someone owned a restaurant, like a little coffee shop, you know what? I guarantee their son wouldn't be going to war. He'd be taking over the coffee shop.
Probably going to take over. Yeah.
That's the one thing I had about Michael Moore was just because it was to me, and that's where I come up with the propaganda. It's not, but it's you're right. It's not their view,
and it's not a documentary.
I mean, it's their view. Yeah.
It is his view. So it's not. There's movies like that, and that I have in the 10 worst documentaries.
Now what? Okay, you did a documentary.
Yeah, Afghanistan.
It's called Afghanistan. Now, what's that about?
Okay, it's I've been to Iraq and Afghanistan 6 times to do USO shows.
Okay.
I'm actually going to Kuwait in September. It's a documentary about the first time I went to Afghanistan to do shows for the military.
Okay.
And I just brought a little camera with me, and I just let the cameras roll. And I had no clue what I was getting myself into. I don't come from a military family or anything like that.
Okay.
And I
now, was this during wartime?
Yeah, I went to Afghanistan in 2004 and 2006 and 2007. So this is from the 2004 trip.
All right.
And so the invasion of Afghanistan started in October of 2001. So we'd been there for 3 years.
Okay.
And so I'm in a war zone. It's what being in a war zone is through the eyes of a comedian. I just rolled the camera and I was kind of freaking out. I was like, what did I just... Once I got there, I was like, oh, God, this is way more than I bargained for.
I mean, what was going on? What was it? I mean, what's...
It's the reality. You're there, and you can watch it on the news all you want. But right. When you're in a war zone, and you're flying in a Black Hawk, they give you body armor to wear. The first Black Hawk I was ever on started shooting at something.
Oh, wow. That's terrifying. Yeah, I mean, I would be
crossing just like,
myself.
What are you... And you're strapped in, and there's nothing you can do. And then, you know, we got to this real remote base, and there's landmines everywhere, and they're like, that's where the rocket attack happened, and everyone's got a gun.
Okay.
So it's no bullshit. You are in a... It is life
right.
or death. It's not movies. It's not CNN.
Right.
It is for real. And until you're standing in the middle of it, when I stood there and finally realized where I was, and this was not a joke, and this wasn't some crazy comedy tour, I was like, oh, it kind of overwhelmed me.
Right.
And you see everything. You know, there's kids, there's the kids on the other side of barbed wire wanting you to give them food because there's a lot of orphans. And Afghanistan's the most heavily mined country in the world because of the Soviets in the 80s. And you're hearing all these stories, and they're taking you into the hospital, and they're operating on kids that were playing in a minefield, and you meet wounded soldiers, and you see flag-draped coffins, and you see everything, man.
Right, right. Now, when you were there, did you hear bombs and stuff going in the background? Did you hear any of that stuff?
Yeah, I heard some mortar fire in the distance, and
well, you must be sitting there just like crapping yourself. It must be like it's real. It's not what we're used to.
Uh-uh.
And it's just, I mean, it's actually,
you know, unless you've had a near death experience, most of us sort of logically know that we could die at any moment.
Right.
You know, oh wow, I could have a heart attack, or boy, I could walk down the street and get hit by a thing, or whatever. But there, it is right in your face, and you know.
Well, it makes you notice that you are invincible. It's like when I went through my heart problem, I was like sitting there, because you think, oh, nothing,
yeah.
And all of a sudden they go, you have congestive heart failure, which I don't have to get operated or anything, but I have to change my life. And if I don't take my medicine, if I go out drinking, if I smoke cigarettes, I'm going to die. But mm-hmm. It's like. Until you go through something like that and you see this, it's like you can have, like for me, it's like I have friends who are like, oh yeah, well come on, have a go, let's do a shot. I'm like, no. I said, no, guys, I'm
it
hanging out.
It could kill me.
And then they go, you gotta live. I go, yeah, it's easy for you to say you have to live when you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like when you're over there, it's like, it's easy for people to go, oh yeah, so you're gonna go do your USO tour. And they're thinking of Bob Hope. It's like, no, you're going over to where you could have died.
Sure.
Bomb and you're on a base, and especially an isolated base, I mean, it must be crazy.
I was on a Black Hawk the second time I went there. We got into a firefight.
Now
we're in a 45-minute firefight, man.
So what is a firefight like?
You're in a helicopter. Okay, so you're in a helicopter. It's a Black Hawk helicopter, and basically the gunner was about from me to you.
Okay.
And he just starts opening up, and he's just like, bah, 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 and there's spent shells hitting my face. We bank up really high to the left, and we go around the other way. The gunner on the left side starts shooting. They release flares, which is countermeasures for when you're targeted by a rocket. And it's game on, man. I mean, like, I don't know, maybe we would have got blown out of the sky. I mean,
right.
It was like, it was April 27, 2006. And so...
See, I can tell because you remember the date, and that's what you can tell. That was like, that's when
date.
You crapped yourself. You're like, oh my God. I mean,
well, that day was funny. That was the second time I had gone, and I was like, I wasn't as freaked out because I was a little more used to it. And I remember that. I remember distinctively when that firefight was happening, thinking to myself, well, everyone in my family knows I love them.
Right.
We just did a show last night in Jalalabad. So I'm out here doing what I love. I'm trying to be of service to people. And if I die, this is it.
Now, when you're in the Black Hawk, were they transporting you to another show?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. We had just done a show and we're flying to
I would think, I mean, I don't know. I mean, and you probably did this in your documentary. I would just think it's like when you're going to a, and you love doing comedy, but it's like when you're going to a job where you love the job, but you hate the boss, that you have that nervousness. It must've been like, you must've been like, you sit there and go, I love performing, but damn it, I might get shot at again. It must have been a lot going through your mind.
It's such an intense experience. You really feel every emotion at its zenith, and you're physically uncomfortable. You're sleep deprived. You're jet lagged. You're sleeping on cots. You're wearing body armor. It's 100 degrees. you know, you're eating military food. It's right. It's really physically and emotionally challenging. And then you do these shows, and the way that the soldiers, the folks in the military thank you is a humbling type of reward that you can't get anywhere else.
Okay.
And it's just like, and you know, I've had commanding officers tell me and other comics that have gone over there, you know, when most of the tours I went on, we were specifically designed to go to small fire bases. We did some big bases, but really wanted to go to the small bases where they don't get anything.
Okay.
And you know, there's some 19, 20 year old kid out there who's just like, you know, thanks for coming out here. And I've had commanding officers, as I was going to say, tell me and other comics that the suicide rate goes down when comedy shows come through.
Wow. Wow.
And you hear that and you're just like,
it's like, wow. It's like for us, it's like, as you perform, it's like, but then you're going, wow, we're making that much difference.
You don't think of it, you know, because we start out, like you said, you're driving around doing one-nighters on the road and some Holiday Inn off a freeway. Yeah, and you're getting $150 bucks and free drinks. And
exactly.
It doesn't seem like it's that valuable.
Right, but it, I mean, it is.
And it is.
I mean, it's, they get started. Now, the documentary, how long of a movie is it?
It's a 90-minute documentary.
Okay, now, does it follow you with, like, your emotional struggle and your grip? Now, and was that hard to film, or?
Well, what I was doing was, I just had a little handheld Sony camera, and I would just turn the camera on myself and start talking. And it was really the only, there and on stage were the only places I was ever, like, talking and exploring emotionally what I was going through, because, you know, I felt like, hey, I'm here to do my job. I'm a professional. So when I'm talking to the soldiers and when I'm doing shows, I'm being an entertainer. I'm being funny, I'm being nice, I'm affable. And then I'd come back to the tent and I'd be alone or something, and I'd start talking to the camera and go, what the fuck was that? Like, this is terrifying. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm never coming here again. Like, you know.
So, I mean, you were like an emotional roller coaster.
Oh, it was such an emotional roller coaster. There's a scene in there where I'm just like, that when I first get there, and first realize where I'm at and what this is going to be, I just start crying and going, I want to go home. You know, I want to get out of here.
It's like the old, it's so funny. It's like a real thing of like when you're in like, when you go to camp.
Yeah, like, man,
but there's a big difference. It's like, so, I mean, it's just, and it's, it must have been, I mean, was there every time you must have just been terrified?
It's a bewildering fear that is, you just can't, even it's hard to explain unless someone else has gone through it, because you're so overwhelmed, because, and part of it is we're Americans where things are very nice.
Right, right.
This is Disneyland, and that Afghanistan is a war-torn third world country.
Right.
That is, so, they did a study. It's about 600-700 years behind us.
Okay.
In terms of technology, sewer system, everything. I mean, at Kabul, the largest city, has an open trench for the sewer system.
Okay, all right. So yeah,
imagine that.
Yeah, it's
a city of 5 million people that has an open trench that just smells like hell.
Right.
And so you see that. You see the abject poverty. You see what three decades of war brings. You see a guy that's, you know, in his late 30s or 40s who looks like he's 70.
Right.
Because he has this tough life. You see, you know, I fed kids food through barbed wire because there's all these orphans, and they ran along the side of a minefield, and in the background is a downed MiG from the Soviets. And like that, I'm not demeaning anyone who's going through a tough time in the States or the poverty here or anything like that. But man.
Oh, yeah, well, that's so funny. It's like,
the dumpster dive movie tells you what we're talking about.
Yeah.
In the garbage is a better
steak.
Meal.
Steak. No, there's steak. Yeah. There's this. I mean, it's just, it's amazing when you see the stuff they have. Now, who were you on the tour with? You were on the tour with Doug Benson?
No. This first time I did it was with Pete Johansson, who's a comic from Canada who'd been living in L.A. Now I think he lives in the U.K. And we just went out there, and the tour was set up by this other comic out of Chicago named Mike Burton. And we just got there, and neither one of us had ever done one of these, and we were
right,
just like,
okay.
You know?
So, now, did you shot a lot of film, and how did you go about cutting it?
I rolled about 80 hours of footage, because I was just rolling the camera constantly, because I was just like, I want to capture this. I was like, at the time, I was like, even if I don't make a movie, I just want to have this.
Oh, yeah, like, it's something different. It's like you sit there and go, wow. It's like, and every time you feel down on yourself, you can put that crap on and go, oh man, you know what?
Yeah.
Guess what?
It's not that hard.
Yeah,
not,
I didn't mean crap like in a bad way.
I've done exactly what you've said, where I'm like, oh, I'm getting down, like, oh, showbiz is hard. And,
right. And then
you know,
go,
some months
wow,
you make
there's
money.
A kid. There's a kid whose dad probably blew up at the mine. Or, I mean, yeah, it's crazy. So now you're also in Super high.
No. I wasn't super high. Real quick, Afghanistan is available as a pay what you think is fair download on comedyfilmnerds.com.
Okay, so it is. Okay, now you got to get this on Netflix.
Well, Netflix, you can see this. I did two different Afghanistan. The first one is called Grandma with Live from Afghanistan. That is what is available on Netflix. I know this is slightly confusing because how many people have two Afghanistan projects?
Hey, Cooper, I'm doing that. I'm doing that Des Moines, Iowa documentary about the five companies up there. Okay, so
Live from Afghanistan is available on Netflix.
Now, is that your stand-up?
That's just me performing over there. So
none of your stuff spliced in?
Not that much craziness. Okay. Afghanistan is the actual documentary that shows all the stuff I'm going through with the emotional roller coaster. It does have some stand-up in it.
Oh, yeah, but of course, intertwined. Yeah, yeah. But that's on Comedy Film Nerds.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, do you have a website?
GrahamElwood.com.
Is it on there?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's links to everything. You just go to grahamelwood.com. There's links
to everything. Go to that, because I think, it sounds like a really good movie, and you people should watch it. And it's like, especially people who are bitching about their lives right now.
Well, yeah.
You know, this is the guy who was freaking out, and you see what else is out there. It's not, there's a big difference between different places. Now, okay, we have about 4.5 minutes left.
Yes, I was in Super Jaime.
Okay. Now, what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about Super Jaime, or what do you want to talk about?
I don't know. What we can talk about?
Because I haven't seen it. I always want to, I'm not going to have to watch it. I always go by it, and I go, I got to watch that. And now, I'm not a pot smoker, but I mean, I have friends who are, and the reason I don't smoke pot is I smoked it in college. It was New Jersey stuff. It was crap. I smoked some of the stuff out here. I mean, as I said, like the stuff out here, like these buds, like look like they should be like a carnation for a couple getting married at a fish concert.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I couldn't move. I smoked it. I was like,
It's crazy. I don't smoke pot either. I don't drink or do drugs or anything like that. I've been on the road for the last like 4 years with Doug Benson,
okay.
And I'm one of the people who is in Super Jaime, where he smoked pot every day for 30 days and then went 30 days without smoking or drinking. And the results are actually very fascinating. It's a good documentary.
I know. I always want to watch it.
It's obviously funny, but the statistics in there, they were very earnest in gathering the stats.
See, that's good.
And they did it. They made a documentary.
Right, right.
And they wanted to show. Let's see what happens. Is pot bad for you or is it not?
Right.
And so they went into that, and it was really fascinating. And then, so it's been cool. I've been on the road a fair amount. You know, when I don't headline like I'm doing in Philadelphia, September 5th through the 8th.
Heliumcomedy.com.
I'll go on the road with Doug and you know, he has a lot of stoner fans, obviously, and that's cool. And we just did another movie called Greatest Movie Ever Rolled, which is like a tour movie. He and I on the road, kind of this odd couple.
Okay.
And that should be coming out soon.
So you're really into the documentary genre.
Yeah, again, because like I said, the technology, you just grab some cameras, and if there's something interesting you want to shoot, you can do it. And it's such a fascinating way to shed light and show parts of this country and the world that many people wouldn't get to see. It's really interesting to do. I think it's a great medium.
Okay, we got
to
wrap up soon, but okay, best cop and robber movie.
Oh, I put The Godfather. You know what I mean?
Well, that's classic.
You gotta do that. Well, there's also Thief. This is a great movie, Thief.
It's James Caan?
James Caan.
Okay, or Stephen Bauer?
Yeah, it's an amazing film. Check out Thief.
Okay, and how about Worst?
Oh, there's so many bad ones. I would probably have to say, oh, God, I'm blanking on the...
Okay, how about Best Kung Fu?
Best Kung Fu is 36 Chamber of the Shaolin.
Okay, and Worst?
Gymkhana.
Oh my God, Kurt Thomas, I forgot about that. Yeah, because it was like Kurt Thomas did that, and it's like the other guy did an American
Ninja or whatever.
No, American, like he played like,
oh,
real,
yeah.
It was real. But then Kurt Thomas did Gymkhana. Oh my God.
The movie poster was the thrill of gymnastics with the kill of karate.
God,
Gymkhana.
That's so funny.
There's a pommel horse in this prison that he goes to fight guys in. And he
I got it. I always forget, like my friend always brings up, my friend brings up Manimal.
Yeah, yeah.
Manimal. And so you forget about that stuff. And, you know, it's crazy. So, okay, give all your information again so they can give them where they can get everything.
Go to everything. Just go to grahamelwood.com. There are links to everything. My film, Comedy Film Nerds, all of it. Grahamelwood.com. Tour dates, everything. Twitter, Facebook, grahamelwood.com.
And now Comedy Film Duds, it's up there. Is there a live episode? Do you do a live episode, or it's just everything's recorded?
Everything's recorded there, comedyfilmnerds.com. You can download it, live stream it. We have an iPhone app.
I want to get an iPhone app. That's cool.
Yeah.
I have an Android. I mean, no, I'm on Podbean. Podbean's my holder.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they said you can do an app, and I have the advanced plan. I'm such a computer idiot. I can't
do it.
I can't figure it out. I'm like,
it's not that hard. I was dumb too.
I'm awful at it. So okay, so you do that. You're playing Helium. People go see him in Philly, and just thank you for being on.
Thanks,
and,
Steve.
Now I gotta sit there. Now I'm gonna go home and watch Super Size Me. Now I'm gonna probably get Afghanistan.
Super High Me.
Super High Me. Yeah, God, I'm out of it. I'm probably gonna get Afghanistan because I just love the documentaries.
Pay what you think is fair, man. You can get the movie for as little as a penny.
I would never do that, though. That's always that disgusts
Thank you.
Me. It's
I like appreciate
people
that.
Do that. Say, go play with Muffer dinner. Here's $2. Get out of here. You say to filet mignon. Anyway, people, follow me at Twitter. It's at Cooper Talk. You can also hit me an email, Cooper at Indie100.com. Go to CooperTalk.net. Put the www first on, and you can hear about 95 past episodes. Also, my new blog is Cooper Thought. At podbean.com. I just write some random things. I tweet it all the time. He's going to be in Philly in September, that 5th through 8th. I'll be in Philadelphia September 20th and 21st at the Georgine's Comedy Works in Bristol. I'm going to thank you guys. Have a great weekend. And remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. And you have a wonderful day.